While the members of the First and Second Fleets were struggling to survive in Botany Bay, back in Europe, the Industrial Revolution was getting underway. The empires that the British, the French, and other European nations had built up became handy sources of raw materials for manufacturing and markets for the factories' products. At the same time, economic history was being made by developments like the limited company and the invention of insurance. A new book, Bourgeois Dignity, Why Economics Can't Explain the Modern World, argues that over time we've stopped being able to appreciate what happened then. Its author, Deirdre McCloskey, is Distinguished Professor of Economics, History, English and Communication at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She calls what happened a revolution in rhetoric. I asked her what she meant.
It is an ancient word which ought to be more honorable than it is. In English, we have lots and lots of words for bad speech. I think we need a word for honest speech, or in any case, the art of speaking that's neutral, and it might as well be that old Greek word.
I suppose it's accrued some of the meanings of highfaluting speech. You'd have to grab it back, wouldn't you?
That's often thought of, but that's not how I think of it or how sophisticated students of these matters think about it. As Aristotle called it, simply the art of persuasion. And we certainly need persuasion in the world, because the only alternative to persuasion is violence. So if we're, and I would claim that there was a rhetorical change in the 17th and 18th century that increasingly allowed people to think about their futures and innovation in civilized conversation instead of in orders and confrontations and violence. The coffee house of the late 17th century, or the newspaper of the 18th century. These are characteristic middle-class institutions in which people were free to imagine progress.
You say that conventional economics doesn't really explain the world that we live in. What would?
Well, what would is a combination of economics and the humanities. What's extraordinary about the modern world, or one of the things that's extraordinary about it, is indeed its very rich economic life. Reinforced concrete, TVs, the ability to talk on the phone across continents, these are all extraordinary. So they're economic consequences. But I argue in the book that the ultimate causes were changes in what Marx called ideology, and I call rhetoric, that were what was unusual about Northwestern Europe. Because, you know, the ordinary things that economists consider trade and exploitation and investment and so forth, those existed everywhere. They existed in the Roman Empire and China and Japan and so forth, and yet didn't result in an industrial revolution in the modern world.
So, in practical terms, how would you translate that into the real world, the modern world?
The real world, when you come to think about it, has to be a world of language. The way we organize corporations, the way we talk in markets, the way we think up innovations are all matters of language. So real is verbal. My examples of this, and what made it possible to write this book, are China and India. In 1978, the Chinese Communist Party decided to allow people to innovate. All of a sudden, the Chinese economy started growing at 8 to 10% in real terms every year. And then in 1991, the same thing happened in India. And since then, the Indian economy has been growing at 7 to 8% per capita every year. Now, those are enormously fast economic growths, and they're the most important fact in the modern world. They're the most important event in the last 30 or 40 years.
But can China continue to prosper if it only liberalizes its economy and doesn't allow people to think, speak, and vote freely?
No, I don't think it can. And the examples of Korea, South Korea, and Taiwan stand out in this, because those countries too were authoritarian and unfree, and then they enriched and became free. Now they have free elections in both countries. And I expect that'll happen to China. But, you know, China is still very, very poor. Average incomes in Australia are on the order of 110 $110 American dollars earned and spent every day, okay, about $110. On that same scale, Chinese national income per head is about $13 a day.
India has liberalized and already has a form of democracy. Is India eventually likely to overtake China?
Oh, absolutely. I was so depressed for a long time because the largest authoritarian country and unfree country in the world, China, was growing so much faster than India. But thank God, the largest democracy in the world in 1991 freed up its economy more or less in the same way that Australia did at the same time. And there were just spectacular consequences in India. In the long run, I think the creativity of the Indian economy, it's a tremendously diverse place, as you know, is going to count in its favor. But I don't want to act as though this is a horse race. I'm just thrilled that this 40% of the world's population is now rapidly entering the modern world.
Professor Deirdre McCloskey of the University of Illinois at Chicago.